From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning. Focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made as we move almost through the month of July, heading through this hot summer, heading to the beginning of our great Catholic schools in August. We're pleased and honored to be joined by the executive director of our Catholic schools throughout all 20 counties of the Diocese of Sacramento, Lincoln Snyder. Lincoln, good day.
Yeah, good day to you.
Wow. We talk regularly, and no matter what we talked about the last time, there's something new or something different virtually every time we talk. This is a rapidly changing situation.
Yeah, you know, it's been fascinating as we've been moving back toward toward the return to school and our start date. You know, parents would love to know what's happening in a month, and very often we just have to sit back and say, well, think about how much things changed week to week and month to month over the past 5 months. And as much as we all hope that that rate of change may slow down, we haven't been granted that reprieve yet. And so, yes, it's been busy.
So tell us, well, let's go back to March the 13th, Friday the 13th.
Friday the 13th.
We all remember that date where, no more in-person school. And by Monday, March the 16th, you guys were up and operating with distance learning, virtual learning, whatever people want to call it, overnight, and went that went, whether you knew it at the time or not, that ended up being all the way through the end of school.
It did. You know, so we found ourselves committing to distance learning for a two-week period that became a month-and-a-half period, and by the time that we saw that the curve was not flattening too quickly and public health was asking us to simply plan on being in distance mode through the end of May, we knew that was a commitment to finishing the school year in distance learning. So we, our parents and students really played ball. I mean, this meant all sorts of end-of-year rituals like graduation and promotion ceremonies had to change or become drive-by or drive-through, rather, and, be held online in some form. And, I think everybody saw all sorts of creative solutions by all schools, public and private, to make sure we were getting to a dignified end of the school year and giving our kids the recognition they deserve. And certainly it's a graduation that was unique for a lot of the kids that are in 8th and 12th grade this past year.
Yeah, I've told those graduating seniors, you've got a story to tell that nobody else will have. Your grandma kept talking about, taking the horse-drawn wagon in the snow both ways uphill. Well, you got a better story now. You were the COVID generation, and you had a virtual graduation and a virtual prom and everything else. And I think with some of the kids, it may have eased the pain that they were kind of in this very unique class that survived all this. So when you first went to this, the thought was maybe this will just be a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, we knew, optimistically, we hoped that we could come back as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And from the moment we closed our campuses and moved to distance mode, we were already working toward that plan for returning to in-person instruction. But I think as we got into it, it became pretty clear pretty quickly that it's something that we're going to have to live with for a while. This is a public health challenge, and we don't have a vaccine. And, I know it's a very vigorous debate, and without taking a side on that, one or the other, and I'm sure every listener would agree that there's the question of schools, and then there's the question of the broader public interest. And we just knew that a discussion around what's best for the kids and what's best for the whole community was going to be an ongoing debate. So, no, I think from the moment we went into distance mode, we hope to be back, but we're prepared for this to be a longer haul challenge.
Yeah, and you're exactly right. It's a heated topic. It doesn't always fall on political lines, but there are lines in the sand that people are drawing. And regard and you know, it's the health and safety of the kids. It's the best learning environment for the kids. It's also whether it's in person or virtual, how does that affect society as a whole? More than just health and safety, all the other things. But I think the one thing that most people, if they put down their guard and just one-on-one, so most people would agree that in-person learning is by far the best learning environment in a perfect world.
It is. And you know, for us, the question has always been what's best for the kids. And there's the health factor or quotient in that answer, which is always foremost, health and safety.
Sure.
There's also a question of the broader picture of what's best for child development. And, I'm sure a lot of the listeners have seen articles coming out over the last few weeks in mainstream press, like the Washington Post or the LA Times or the Economist or the Wall Street Journal. As countries are coming back out of distance learning and out of quarantine and returning to school, and there's countries that are well ahead of us on this, they haven't necessarily seen spikes in COVID rates overall as kids have gone back to the classroom. And so, we're studying this very closely as a system as why. You know, what have they done to protect our students? You know, part of it is cultural or behavioral in that, we really have been working hard on our protocols for the schools to make sure that our schools are a strong link in the chain for when kids come back to the classroom, that we've got all sorts of safeguards in place, and part of the reason in places like Finland or Germany in countries in Asia that have gone back to school, the reason there hasn't been an overall increase is because when children have returned to the classroom, the protocols have been so good in the classroom that you can never eliminate 100% of the risk. But the classroom's the safest environment, bar none, of any place the kid is during the day. And very often, and I've seen this in my neighborhood, that yes, we've been in social distancing, but I don't think the teenagers got the memorandum in my neighborhood. And so there's risk to kids being out of school too.
Yeah.
And so that I think that's the debate that parents said, well, obviously there's risk everywhere, and how do we balance these risks? And so I've gotten dozens and dozens of messages from parents. Last Friday, I probably got 75 emails from parents weighing in on different sides. People are very passionate about this balancing of interests. Where's the safest spot for our kids? What's best for them overall? What's best for society overall?
Yeah, I mean, you're right about the teenagers and apparently a number of young adults not getting the memo. It's very clear, as we've seen the shift of infections go down to a lower age group, not in the elementary age group, but down into the 20s, 30s, 40s, when it used to be most of the infection was in a much higher age group.
Yes. And, some of the things we're learning and what working with public health, we see that the younger the children are, there seems to be a greater degree of protection afforded by age. Broadly speaking, nothing's perfect, and I'm generalizing here, but it seems that younger kids don't infect each other as easily as older kids do or as adults do. And adult-to-child infection with the younger guys is actually pretty rare. And again, these are statistics. I mean, I'm not talking about the story of any one person because I'm sure listeners are saying, well, I know a different case. And I'm not...
Yeah, you can have exception to every rule.
Yeah, absolutely. But, these are the kind of things that we have to look at really seriously as we work with our advisors and with the county and coming up with a protocol to make sure that we're taking every precaution. And, I think that there's a growing consensus in public health around younger kids perhaps having more inherent protection from resistance to this disease. They're not getting it as quickly. They're not suffering the same consequences. And it's tougher for them to give it to each other. So, the science is... There seems to be a broad consensus on that, though there's always exceptions, right? And so I think the thing that we've been keeping in mind is, Governor Newsom had a press conference on Friday and talked about the new protocols going forward, and we've been making announcements publicly about how we're managing that. Is that we understand that there's differences by community with infection rates and how the community has to respond. So, I think public health was very clear at the state level that the county and at the county level and the regional level is still our lodestar. And, for us, having schools in 11 of our 20 counties of the diocese and having, 102 parishes across all 20 counties, you're going to see regional differences in what we're able to do with reopening or not. You know, that's one aspect. The other aspect is for us as private schools and as Catholic schools, we're doing our best really to work with our communities, with the parents. And, the parents have a very strong sense of what's best for their child and for their family, as they should.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for us also making sure that as we assess our options and express plans, that we are being very respectful of parental choice. And so a lot of the things we put in place, I think, reflect that.
Yeah, it's very basic to Catholic teaching that the parents are the first educators of our kids. You're right. The passion on, and it's more than two sides. There's about six sides to this debate. But I always feel when you have a difficult issue, and maybe you've taken a position on one side, it's always best to look, what is the strongest argument on the other side? And how do I respond to that in an honest way? In terms of opening schools, what's the strongest argument in favor of that? And in terms of virtual learning, not opening the schools to in person, what's the strongest argument in favor of that?
Yeah, so I think in favor of opening is, as we're looking at other countries that have reopened, COVID rates aren't going up overall.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it just seems that, not that there isn't risk anywhere, just by being a human being, there's an inherent risk of catching something from another human being. But in countries that have reopened overall, because schools with strong protocols are about the safest place a kid can be, overall they're not any more likely to get COVID at school than they are if school didn't happen. So it's not this binary thing where kids go to school and there's mm-hmm. risk, and kids don't go to school and there's 100% safety. The thing is, kids don't go to school and then they're still engaging with other people in community anyway. We feel very strongly that just based on the data we've seen, that if we handle these protocols right, and our principals have been publishing the protocols for our schools, that we're doing things like keeping our kids in cohorts. So if there's there is an illness in one cohort, it doesn't mean that anyone else in the school was necessarily exposed. We are working really hard on things like masks and hand washing and hygiene and our training for our kids, about training them to learn into little one-person hygiene armies, which has also worked for the adults and, for example, frontline responders that have been out in the field since March, and they've broadly avoided infection because they've been doing the same thing, cohorts and hygiene. So, we think those practices have been proven to be effective. But at the same time, we know that there's some families that might have a child or a family member that is in a high-risk group, and just... The statistics aside, they are not comfortable making that choice to send their child to school. So we've been working very hard to come up with a solution for them, too. And so for our Catholic school families that want to remain in distance learning mode, we're going to completely work with them on supporting them throughout the school year. We know in every single school, we're going to have families with either the child or perhaps a member of the household that simply can't risk infection, and the mm-hmm. parents are making the very... considered personal decision to keep their child learning from home for that year.
Right.
We're going to support them in that. So at the same time, we also know that, for example, things like preschools and daycares for frontline responders have never ceased operating and have operated successfully throughout COVID. We've got a lot of, police officers and nurses and firefighters and teachers and other essential people in our schools, that they have to be out in the community serving,
right.
And they need a safe place for their child. So it's our goal to provide a place for them, too. I think that there's a risk, there's the social emotional risk of kids not being at school, and this is again the part that's so personal to every single parent. I mean, it's not our job to tell them what's right for their child, but there's a lot of parents that would make the considered choice to send their child to school if they have that option, because they think that it's best for their child's overall social emotional health,
sure,
and welfare balance against the risks. And so, like I said, for us as community schools, we are looking at public health directives and the governor's directives and trying to offer our families as many options and as many choices as possible.
So all summer long, or all spring and summer, you're planning for in-person in August, and then a few days ago, the governor added a number of counties to the watch list, and suddenly it's like an 8.4 earthquake. Everything gets shaken up. Where do things stand now?
Well, you know, some of our counties, just to be clear, are not on the watch list.
Right.
So, you know, our first day of school is set for August 12th, plus minus a day, depending on the particular school. So I know that some of our schools and some of our communities will be opening in person on time, in total keeping with public health. So,
and those are in the counties that are not on the watch list?
Not on the watch list. You know, for the counties that are on the watch list, that if we're not able to open, first of all, you know, some counties have reached out to us and said that, you know, we do not anticipate coming off the watch list, and we are asking people to remain in social distancing mm-hmm. for a little bit longer to bring down the numbers. So where we're not on the watch, we're in a county where we are on the watch list, and public health is making it clear that we shouldn't expect those numbers to drop and the county come off the watch list. You know, many of our schools in those counties would have no choice but to start in distance mode. However, you know, we are working toward a day soon in September in those counties where we would be able to offer other on-campus options as well.
Mm-hmm.
So just so families know, the governor announced a waiver process for elementary schools in counties that are on the watch list. That waiver process does not exist yet. And so they announced that they want to have one, but they don't know exactly what that means, and so they're creating one. But the family said, well, can't we get a waiver? Well, theoretically we can, but as I've worked with the counties, they don't know. They haven't established that process yet, so we have to wait and see on that front.
So
you know, we also know. So go ahead.
So basically the governor's saying, here's the rules. They're hard and fast. 1, 2, 3, 4. You're on the watch list. You're not on the watch list. You can do this. You can't do this. But we're open to perhaps making exceptions if you can sort of prove your case that you have special circumstances or you've taken special steps which will ensure the safety even if maybe you are in a county on the watch list.
Yes, and it may even be, and in talking with some directors of health for certain grades, they know that the risk is not the same for all kids of all ages.
Mm-hmm.
A child who's 17 is responding to COVID differently on average than a child who's 6.
Right.
And so it's been expressed that perhaps there's a clear case for the younger kids being able to go back to school for the state. And I'm not talking about any one community, but across the board,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a much clearer case for kindergarten having far less risk being in class than, say, seniors
right.
in high school. So they're working through what that means. And so, you know, of course, I know some of our parents are frustrated that the process was announced and it wasn't in place, but, you know, so be it. Our policy has been to work with public health, and they're the ones who approve the waiver. So, you know, we have to work with them and be patient in them to come up with that process, and then county by county, we'll find out what that means. So that's one option. The other one is the protocol for preschools and daycares has not changed. And so even if a county were to not be able to return to in-person instruction, which is the language used in the document, you know, it appears that our preschools and our daycares, they have very strict protocols for the operation of preschools
mm-hmm.
and daycares. So just so families understand, it's not the same thing as just going to class. There is more distancing. There is a greater ratio of adults to children. There's special licensing with inspections that takes place to have a preschool or a daycare. It's a stricter standard, but daycares operated throughout COVID and they will continue to operate. Again, many of our families are first responders and they need a place for their child, and the state has acknowledged that. So we're working on those options too, just to make sure that we, again, you know, the policy changed really quickly. Not all details have been thought through. Or at least they hadn't had time to process all the details. I know this has been taxing for our parents, looking for clarity from yours truly and others saying, okay, what exactly does this mean? And all I can say is the public health is figuring it out, and again, it's our goal to give parents as many options as possible. So, just to finish this up, so as far as from my desk, we're not having one blanket statement for the diocese as a whole because it's not a diocesan-wide solution. It's going to be a county-by-county determination as to what we're able to do next. And so as listeners are hearing this, we will have gotten out announcements in many counties about us opening on the regularly scheduled date with in-person instruction or, in some cases, announcements that we're starting with distance learning for the short term, but hoping to be back to class in person as soon as possible and certainly doing all we can to offer families who need it an on-campus option as quickly as possible, hopefully in September.
And it's a double-edged sword. You can be a county that's on the watch list, and you can come off the watch list, and the reverse is true.
Yes. Well, the good news with this protocol is if a county comes off the watch list and schools open, just because this county goes back on the watch list doesn't mean that all schools have to close.
Uh-huh.
The way it works is once schools are back in session and operating, then we have to monitor school by school. And mm-hmm. So the way it reads is that if a child takes sick in one class, and the class is what they call a cohort, that class needs to go home and quarantine for 2 weeks. But if 5% of kids in a school take ill, then the school has to go home for 2 weeks. And if a quarter of the schools in a district close, then the whole district closes. So that's the standard that the governor put in the new return to school guidelines.
Lincoln, I'm assuming you must be getting a few phone calls from your counterparts in the public schools saying, how are you doing this? How are you going to do in person? What's your model? You must be much in demand.
Part of my wish is we had gotten more calls from our public school counterparts, but, you know, to be fair to them, they've got very different decisions.
They do.
Factors influencing the decisions than we do. You know, right. So in particular, they've got some laws on the books and some collective bargaining agreements with some pretty strong provisions about transitioning from distance learning to regular instruction and back that I think, it's different from district to district, but one of the advantages of being private schools is we do have a lot of flexibility. In other words, the California Department of Education has guidelines, and I know your listeners' eyes are glazing over as I say this, but the CDE has guidelines, and then the California Department of Public Health has guidelines. And for us as private schools, rather, we're following public health and not Department of Education. And so, I know I'm slipping into, bureaucratic speak here, but it is a big difference. It gives us a lot more flexibility as private schools.
Are other private non-religious or other religions, what is there a sense of what they're doing?
Yeah, so we do share some advocacy representatives. So we've got a great public advocate down at the Capitol that represents all private schools.
Mm-hmm.
He's out of Jewish education in Los Angeles, and so I'm proud to say that, we're very ecumenical as private schools when it comes to advocating for the interests of private schools. I mean, obviously, we all have our own faiths and or philosophies, but, when it comes to advocacy, there's a lot in common in terms of, protecting our constitutional rights and privileges as private schools, and so we talk and we collaborate, and I think this is one of those cases where private schools are very much on the same page and talking and collaborating.
Very interesting. Not a possibility of just moving all schools to Modoc County?
That's funny. I think we've got more kids in our Catholic schools in the diocese than there are people in Modoc County.
You're right.
I think we might overwhelm them a little bit.
It's amazing. I was reading a story about they literally have not had a single case in Modoc County, which is in California, which right now is one of the hot spots, and it's very rural. It's up where California meets Oregon and Nevada, that little northeast corner of the state. I think it's Sacred Heart Parish up there in Alturas, and you don't have a school up there, obviously. It's just not the population, but it is interesting how it really does vary from place to place.
It does. I took a summer vacation up to the western states, and I was in Helena, Montana. Lewis and Clark County had a total of 67 cases,
right.
No fatalities. And so But they were in social distancing mode. It wasn't that different. I mean, I was able to get a haircut in Boise, Idaho. So, you know, again, it's different state by state. But yeah, I think the, you know, the final thing I will say on the policy side, and as people are asking what's important or what has to happen next, or, you know, what should we be paying attention to? And this comes back to our rural counties. You know, testing is really important for us as schools. And I will just say objectively that there's not enough tests out there, and that is a big concern for us. That even if we had an outbreak in any one particular school, one of the public health concerns about reopening is that the kits, they've been shutting down free test centers because they don't have enough kits, and then even with the kits they've got, the labs are overwhelmed, and it takes them about a week to process. And so, I mean, I was talking through county health, they're very clear that they are just desperate to have more resources available for testing. And so for all of those concerned about, you know, any businesses, but in particular schools, you know, and other community organizations getting back to campus or back to service, you know, I would say that the lack of testing resources is a challenge for everybody, because that kind of leaves public health at a loss to say, well, you know, we go back, but then people take ill and we don't know if they've got it or not, so we have to presume they do, and that means we've got tighter restrictions. So, like I said, I would just say that if anybody's talking to their political representatives, like the one thing I would say that hopefully sounds, you know, relatively objective or nonpartisan, Bob, would be that, you know, it would really benefit our schools and our church a lot if there were more resources available for testing.
Yeah, and I agree with you that there may be some people try to make that a political statement, but it's not. And most experts you talk to say, yeah, we need more testing, and we hopefully need a way to make the results much more quick, because that lag creates a lot of uncertainty, and also can spur the infection rate, because somebody goes and gets a test and doesn't think they're sick and waits 7-10 days. Are they still going to the store? Are they still out in the community thinking, I don't have it, when in fact they do?
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Very, very difficult. Well, you know, my wife's a Montana native, so she's been following it up there pretty closely. She's already picked all the places we could go and pitch a tent.
Oh yeah, no, Montana was great. I'll just I had never, one of the books I had to read in college was Undaunted Courage, and so about Lewis and Clark. And so my wife had to suffer through me nerding out over the being in Lewis and Clark County and going to the gates of the Rocky Mountains and the rest of it, but. Yeah. You know, like I said, it's, I think one of the gifts of COVID is, we did exactly what you said. We said, well, let's go somewhere where, you know, we know we can be socially distant and be somewhere beautiful. And we just really lay low and enjoyed the parks. And it was just lovely.
That's great. Did you float the Missouri River?
Did float the Missouri River.
Yeah, boy. I just think back to Lewis and Clark, and I think just how mind-boggling. Is that just myth? Did they really do all that stuff? It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's to actually be there. It was fun. It was really fun. So, like I said, those of you I know that we're all doing our best to stay socially distant, and you know, not many people are flying anywhere right now. You know, just responding to or knowing that we couldn't do our normal vacation, which is get on a plane and fly somewhere, we took a road trip, and that certainly offered its own gifts. It's just beautiful up there.
The good old fashioned family road trip. Done that to Montana many times myself. You know, it's funny. We have our daughters is going to be a sophomore at UC Davis this fall, and they just announced that. For those students who are on campus in a class of less than 50 students, they're going to have tents outdoors. And she wants to know if she needs to bring her own marshmallows. So.
Well, you know, a thought on that. You know, the New York Times ran an article this past weekend talking about 1918 and the Spanish flu, that schools moved outdoors to offer instruction because in 1918 they understood germ theory, and they figured out that H1N1 doesn't really transmit all that well outdoors, and so they moved class outdoors as their plan. And so it's interesting to read about, what happened. You know, I read a book on vacation called The Great Influenza by John Barry about Spanish flu. Strongly recommend it to any of your listeners just to kind of get the long game or perspective on public health and viruses and pandemics. And yeah, it's amazing how we're reinventing the wheel on so many points. Our great-great-grandparents went through all of this a century ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because they've done some great comparisons of how Philadelphia responded and how St. Louis responded, and the difference in the transition rates between those two cities was dramatic. I remember seeing a photo from 1918 of a Georgia Tech football game, and every single person in the stands was wearing a face mask, looking just like the face masks we're wearing today, 100 years later.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, yeah, the outdoors seems to be, and that's my final question. Obviously, the CIF, the California Interscholastic Federation, which controls all the sports in California, has sadly announced that, they haven't canceled fall sports. They've just moved them all to winter, and which will affect our Catholic high schools for sure.
And it will, but, you know, I think that's the message that I've given to my own kids is this: knowing everything we need to do, we really need to encourage our kids to be outdoors and moving.
Yep.
And, so sports aren't happening, and that's partly because of the social aspect or the contact nature of a lot of the games we play. But, based on everything I've seen, you know, playing ultimate frisbee or frisbee golf or playing horse at the, 6-foot distance at the, on the basketball court, et cetera, there's a lot of things that parents can do that would be very, very low risk to keep their kids moving for the fall while hopefully we get back to sports as normal and activities as normal as soon as possible.
Yeah, we've got four teenagers, and it's like an everyday walking, jogging, hiking, biking. There's a lot of things to do, and I tell you, advice to parents: if your kids are in the doldrums and they're just sitting around, and there's lots of outdoors, especially in this great Sacramento Valley, where it's fresh air and socially distanced and really very, very safe.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
Well, Lincoln, I know you're a very, very busy guy. I hope you're getting some sleep. I'm glad you got off to the great Northwest and the Intermountain area and got some R&R. And we'll look forward to talking to you as we soldier through this opening of our great Catholic schools, August the 12th?
August the 12th.
It's upon us.
It is. It's coming up. Coming up quickly.
Very good. Thanks, Lincoln, and God bless you and your staff and all our great faculty and students and parents out there.
God bless, Bob. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Great. Thanks so much. That's Lincoln Snyder, the executive director of all of our Catholic schools here and Catholic schools in 11 of the 20 counties in the Diocese of Sacramento. Some of them will be open, really a handful of them in those counties that aren't on the watch list for the time being. Those that are on the watch list, although we'll learn more about the possible waiver situation where perhaps you can put together a plan that would allow you to get a waiver. We'll see what that had the details of any waiver from the sort of blanket rule about when you can be in person and when you have to be at distance learning. The details of the waiver are yet to come, but we will keep you posted on those as well. And of course, Lincoln will be in contact with all the parents of all the Catholic schools throughout the diocese. We'll take a quick break, back with more on the Bishop's Hour right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
This is Bishop William K. Wiegan, the Bishop Emeritus of Sacramento, and you're listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Denning.
Thank you, Bishop Wiegan, for that great introduction. Bishop Wiegan has done so much for our great diocese and for the Universal Church and the National Church, and continues to do great things here for the Diocese of Sacramento. And his is an interesting story. He grew up in rural northern Idaho, and eventually was ordained and eventually became the Bishop of Salt Lake City, and then from Salt Lake City, where he was did just some remarkable things, and also was very, very popular, and then came here to the Diocese of Sacramento, and then retired 10, 11, 12 years ago, something like that. But as a lot of people know, in retirement, he has remained very, very busy. So we just appreciate all the great things that he has done. So thanks for that great introduction. Well, so much happening here, obviously, in the Diocese of Sacramento. And one of the groups that is just so active, and probably even more active during the pandemic, despite the various restrictions that are out there, is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. And Judy Dietlein joins us now, the president. Judy, good day to you.
Well, good morning, Bob. How are you?
Nice to talk to the president in the morning.
Well, it's just going to be for a couple of more months. They've elected a new president that comes in October 1.
I thought you couldn't elect a new president until November 3rd. And I'm not taking sides or anything. I'm just saying that's the date.
Not in St. Vincent de Paul.
Very good. Is this a surprise announcement, or do we have a name?
No, we have a name. We had the election July 14th, and Joe Alves, who is the current district president in Solano County, will be the new diocesan council president come October 1. Our fiscal year is October 1 to September 30th, so that's why the dates are like that. And so I'm on limited time until September 30th, so I have a lot to get done.
Are you a lame duck?
No, I hope not. I have my agenda, and I'm working it until I can get it done. But in actuality, once a new board is in place, the immediate past president stays on, not to vote, but as an advisor,
right,
and help. And of course, Paul stayed on my board, and Paul Starkey was just an amazing partner for me, and I was lucky to have him. So, we're going forward. I think that it's great to get new blood in and people with new ideas. Joe has done an outstanding job in Solano County. This was the new district council structure that we put into place 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the first one, and he's done an amazing job there. So I can only believe that he is going to continue that work with the council, the diocesan council, come October.
And it's a three-year term, generally?
It's a three-year term. You can be reelected for another 3 years to make it 6 years. I chose to not do another 3 years.
It's a busy job.
It's been challenging sometimes, very rewarding, but I think it's time for me to step back and have someone new come in and further the agenda. There's been so many changes in the Sacramento Diocesan Council over these last few years,
mm-hmm.
and I know Joe has been a great supporter of these changes, and he's just going to keep it going. I can only imagine what he's going to be doing when he takes office. So we're going to be working together for the next couple of months to get him up to speed, because there are different things going on with the diocesan council versus the district council. Mm-hmm. And without an executive director, the president becomes an executive director.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. That leaves a lot of administrative work that he's going to have to get familiar with. But I know he can do it, and I'll be there to help him.
Now, you're located in Solano County, too, correct?
Yes, I live in Benicia.
So Solano County's kind of dominating this thing.
We're making it, I think, understandable by all of the dioceses that it's not just Sacramento.
Yes,
we've got
right.
people in Butte County and Placer and all over the place. And for the longest time, those of us in Solano, and this goes back for me almost 20 years, we didn't even understand why we were part of the Sacramento Council, because we were kind of those little outcasts
right.
there. I think if there's, and there really isn't very much positive coming out of COVID-19, but virtual meetings has brought us all closer together in a faster than it would have in any other way. We've been able to do those Zoom meetings and go to meetings and you name it, and see each other and keep in touch, even though the distances are great. Our furthest conference is up there in Weed.
Wow.
And they hardly ever get to any of the events or meetings, because it's just such an enormously long drive.
Sure. That's right.
So yeah. We get to see Brendan and some of the faces up there up north now that we're meeting on Zoom. So that's a positive change that I think will probably stay for a while. The thing with St. Vincent de Paul, though, is that we're kind of an in-person, personal encounter kind of organization, and that's been very difficult on our members, because when people call us for help, we schedule appointments to meet with them.
Mm-hmm.
And we still respond, but we're responding mostly by phone. Our food programs continue through this whole thing, but food was either delivered directly to the person and placed on their doorstep, or some of the conferences had like a drive-through where you came up to the food pantry
right.
and the groceries were put in your trunk. And so things have continued. We've continued our work. We just do it differently, like almost everybody else in the nation, I guess, in every industry we can think of. You, of course, in radio, you always worked
that's right.
behind the scenes. So nothing's right. changed for you, has it?
No, it's just the same, except it's a lonely studio, because first off, there's no windows in this little room. You've been here.
Yes.
And I'm so used to in-person interviews where you can look somebody in the eye, you can read their body language, or you start to ask a question and they're shaking their head, say, "Don't ask me that question." It's different, but it's pretty much the same. We Flatlanders up here in the valley, we tend to think of Benicia and Vallejo as Bay Area. I mean, much mm-hmm. more. We don't think of it as part of the valley, even though the diocese goes all the way to Lake Tahoe and goes all the way up into Modoc County and, you say, Weed and Yreka and all those places. It is so far flung. And to see, I think it's great that we've got Zoom where somebody in Benicia, somebody in Weed, somebody in Yreka can all be together and chat.
Yeah, it's been a real boon to our communications, I can say that. And I think that's going to continue. Many of our events and our meetings, both for Sacramento and our region and national, have been pretty much just all canceled. So keeping in touch with webinars has been very helpful as well. And the national meeting that normally takes place in September, of course, was canceled, mm-hmm. but they plan on doing a virtual meeting for us. They haven't given us the details yet, but they're going to do that. One of the more challenging areas is fundraising, because, as you know, and you've attended, our annual benefit dinner for the poor is always in April, and it was, of course, I will say postponed till April of 2021, and I've got my fingers crossed. But people were very generous. Some of them responded and sent in donations, even though we did not have the dinner. And then one part of the dinner is the sale of raffle tickets.
Mm-hmm.
We always give away a Hawaiian trip, and that's always a pretty exciting part of the dinner. And so the conferences continued to sell tickets, although very difficult because most of them would sell them after masses.
Right.
And with churches closed, that left them to different devices.
Sure.
So we went from April and we said, okay, because nobody knew what was going to come down, we said, okay, we're going to extend it to May and we're going to draw the ticket at our Western Region meeting. Okay, that didn't work out. So we extended it to July 25th, which is this Saturday.
Oh, and so I'm that phone call I've been waiting for that's to tell me I've won. It's still coming.
Yes.
Okay.
So on Saturday, we were a few of us, maybe a dozen, socially distancing with masks, will be in the parking lot of our thrift store on Watt Avenue.
Very good.
At 11 o'clock. And we're very excited because every year this trip is donated by AG Management.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been a great supporter. They've been one of our benefactors for years and years. And two of their staff members are coming on Saturday morning, and they will be picking out that winning ticket.
Oh,
from
wonderful.
The And we are going, Paul, you know how creative Paul is.
Right.
He's going to live stream it on Facebook.
Oh, very good.
So we will be able to announce it immediately as soon as that winning ticket is pulled.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And that'll give some more exposure for our thrift store, which was closed for 3 months. And it reopened June 15th. We have just a wonderful manager there. She's a young woman who's been with the store for maybe 8 years, Victoria, mm-hmm. and she stayed on staff during the closure, and she worked on special projects, and then she put together the reopening program. She stayed in touch with all the employees, and it reopened June 15th with almost every employee that left coming back.
Oh, great.
And all you know, guidelines and requirements were checked off her checklist, and the store is doing very well since it's reopened, so we're very happy about that. They're taking donations, so if anybody out there is listening and has been cleaning out closets while trying to shelter in place, we are open for donations, and, of course, the store is open for sales as well. So Saturday will be the first time I will be up there for since March, I think, 12th, since before, just wow, before we were shut down. So I'm really kind of excited myself to go up there and see everybody.
So are there any, obviously, the state requirements that you had to close down. What allowed you to reopen, and are there any restrictions compared to where you were, say, 2 years ago when the last time I visited the store was about a year ago,
and, yeah,
with one of my daughters, and just I couldn't get her out of there.
You know, we follow all the guidelines for retail, and so she had to put in place requirements for the staff, so they mm-hmm. knew how to sanitize areas, everyone wearing masks, gloves in certain areas, regular sanitizing, the social distancing, especially by the checkout, the cash registers. Mm-hmm. She's got signs on the floor, just like you would see in a supermarket.
Right.
Signage posted everywhere. When people are able to try on clothing, those clothes are then pulled out to be, I don't know the actual way they sanitize it, but they do take it off the floor for a certain mm-hmm. amount of time. So it's not much different from any of the other places that are open for business that have been open, like supermarkets and
hardware stores.
Target,
yeah.
Home Depot. And so as retail reopened, since we are standalone, we're not in an enclosed area, it is quite a large a store, so she was able to move things around to make sure that there's enough space in aisles so people are you know, not crowded. And like anywhere else, if there seems to be too many people in the store, they do limit people from time to time if it gets too overcrowded with people too close to one another. But they have complied with everything that they needed to. She put together a written plan that I was quite amazed with. And we're just so happy that people are coming in and they are shopping. And, you know, because of the economic conditions, it always makes sense that thrift stores thrive when people are suffering, which is unfortunate, but we're happy that we can be there for them so they can get things that are needed. And we do help the conferences with getting what they need for the people that they're working with. They provide vouchers, and we get them beds, we get them clothing, we get them household items.
That had to be a real hole for a number of people who really relied on that during that time you had to be closed.
Yes. As I say, it was 3 months. And even because there was no deliveries, there were no pickups, the conferences were not able to send people there. Victoria, I have to say, when something urgent came up, she would be there to help one of either the members or one of our other staff members. In, you know, we have a disaster recovery program up in Paradise.
Right.
And we have three offices up there, one in Chico, one in Gridley, and one in Paradise at St. Thomas More School.
Mm-hmm.
So, interestingly enough, she hired, we're working under a FEMA grant that is part of Catholic Charities of California. And just before COVID hit, she hired 5 new case managers. She had to train them all. This was when Zoom just came out, she trained them all on Zoom. Wow. Everybody was at home. So some of the new case managers that came on worked at home from March 20th until June 1st.
Wow.
They had never been in an office. But we got, we had leased an office in Gridley just before COVID hit. And so June 1, when they were reopening, they needed furniture. And so our supervisor up there, Stephanie, worked with Victoria at the store, and they delivered all of the office furniture that they needed to the Gridley office just before the new case managers came in to work there. So she has, you know, there's a lot of partnership within our programs. And the other program that Victoria works with is our Exodus Project, which is a reentry program mm-hmm. for returning citizens from the Sacramento jail.
Great program.
Our director, he's Rabbi Seth
right.
Castleman.
Right.
I know you've talked to him, has done such a wonderful job moving this program along, and he has more than half of his mentors have continued to work with their mentees during COVID, keeping in touch via phone and email and text. He is now moving into his own office. He'd worked out of a small office at the thrift store, and now he's ready to move into his own office in downtown Sacramento.
Oh, very good.
And he'll be able to offer many more services. Many reentry programs have tell people while they're incarcerated, there's this program, as soon as you get out, come and see us and we'll help you. It's called a 72-hour transition. Well, it's not something that he could do working out of a little tiny office at the store.
Right.
But once he has his own office, he'll be able to offer that.
Oh, that's good. We'll look forward to getting to Rabbi Seth back on the program, too.
Absolutely. He's doing a great job.
Judy, we're against the clock here. We need to get you back on. We didn't get to cover enough ground, but thanks for all you do. And we will look forward to talking to Joe Alves as well. And hopefully the two of you can come in and you can introduce me to Joe, and we'll go from there.
Sounds good, Bob. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much. God bless, okay. Judy. Take
Bye-bye.
Care. That's Judy Dietline, the head of St. Vincent de Paul throughout the Diocese of Sacramento, outgoing president. She'll be leaving office, as you will, after 3 years. But they, as we've seen from Paul Starkey and John Hallisey and everybody else, they never step aside. They just keep working harder, even though they might not have the title of president anymore. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening. God bless. We'd like to thank all the wonderful people and organizations, businesses in town, and throughout the Diocese of Sacramento who have provided underwriting for the Bishop's Hour, some in the last few years, some have been with us for a very long time. If you would like to be an underwriter for the Bishop's Radio Hour, it's a wonderful opportunity to support this mission and also to support the diocese and also to get some recognition for your organization or for your business. The easiest way to do this is to give us a shout, send us an email, radio@scd.org, and we can give you all the details about helping to underwrite the Bishop's Radio Hour. Again, that's radio@scd.org.
Well, here I am in a river of questions. Can I pour my heart out to a listening ear? But I see this life, it's valleys and mountains, and I think of all the roads that brought me here. Oh, that brought me here. Walking down the road. Well, I've questioned my reasons, this life I'm living. I question my ability to judge wrong from right. But I questioned all the things I've ever called certain. My race, my religion, my country, my mind. But the one thing